Well, perhaps we'll start. Good evening. Welcome to the LSE and to this year's Gender Institute public lecture. It's very nice to see you all here this evening. Now, Susie Orbach, who is to give tonight's lecture, really needs no introduction from me. She is a distinguished psychotherapist. She is co-founder and co-director of the Women's Therapy Center. And she is now, I'm very happy to say, a visiting professor in the Gender Institute. And we count ourselves most fortunate in that regard. Now, she is perhaps best known to many of you, perhaps those of you anyway who are of my generation, for her pioneering book, Fat is a Feminist Issue. But she has not, of course, stopped there. She has gone on writing. She's written a number of books on eating problems and has continued to publish academic articles on issues as diverse as false memory syndrome, parenting, anxiety and risk, psychology and consumption, countertransference, masculinity, intimacy, and anorexia. In addition to which, her work has featured in television documentaries, in films, and in plays. And Susie Orbach is also, of course, well known for her journalism, and she has published a collection of her Guardian columns called What's Really Going On Here? Now, her new book is called The Impossibility of Sex, and I expect with a title like that you should all rush out and buy it, but it won't be available until May. It is, she tells me, a series of stories about imagined patients in psychotherapy told from the perspective of the analyst. Now, it's characteristic of all of Susie Orbach's work that she pursues the question of how psychoanalytic theories and approaches can help our analysis of social problems, problems which are more conventionally seen in economic or social terms. And that she then goes on to suggest innovative ways in which psychoanalysis can contribute both to the formulation of such problems and to their solution. And it is appropriate, therefore, that she should begin continuing this work in the lecture she gives tonight at the LSE. So please welcome Susie Orbach.
I've just lost my bauble, so I think I probably have to put it back on. Is that right? Because otherwise, does it matter? No, I'm okay. I can't see anybody, but I hope that's okay. You can't see me. Shall I sit at the table? I think it's probably easier, right? Because otherwise, okay. Now I have to move the flowers. I'm sorry to do it. I mean, I'm sure this is not what one's meant to do at a public lecture at the LSE, but I'm sorry. Well, thank you very much, Henrietta. I'm very, very pleased to have this opportunity to talk about some of my ideas at the LSE. The establishment of the London School of Economics marked a new moment in the development and application of social theory. The Webbs made the LSE a center for research and dissemination of new kinds of thinking around social issues. And for most of its lifetime, the LSE has occupied a place in our minds as the premier institution committed to understanding how human beings group together and how they act in society. When in search of the assessment of best practice or best theory, governments and intergovernmental agencies look to the academics at the LSE. And in the past few years, we've seen the British government leadership, or in the last 18 months, we've seen the British government leadership taking the ideas of Tony Giddings, the LSE director, to help them frame the issues and potential solutions possible for Britain in its attempt to engage with the problems of today. The intellectual base of the webs and LSE rested on the ideas of economic and social progress, developed in the earlier part of the 19th century as an extension of scientific and rational views. The understandings that were being achieved in the natural world led to the hope that social organization and economic activity would yield rules with similar clarity and an equally pleasing aesthetic. There was an expectation that how human beings behaved in society, in groups, in the family, at work, in the countryside, in the town, and how markets and goods and people interacted could be understood. And if their behavior could not exactly be predicted, we could have a solid enough base or a knowledge base from which to plan economic and social policy. Now, it was in this atmosphere of scientific optimism and 19th century exuberance that Freud undertook the task of understanding individual human behavior. Approaching the study of the individual as a neuroscientist and using metaphors and imagery from 19th century physics, Freud constructed an approach to the human subject which he called psychoanalytic. He devised a novel instrument for the study of the individual, the analytic hour. This is when the patient freely associates on the couch. And via the analytic hour, he undertook the first systematic attempt to understand emotional and psychological processes in the individual. He instituted a practice and a field, psychoanalysis, which over the next 100 years, and it really is only 103 years old, has given us a clinical practice, a theory of mental processes, and a new way to think about femininity and masculinity. Although Freud's life was chronologically contemporaneous with the Webbs, he was born just 2 years before Sidney and 3 before Beatrice. His ideas, as far as I can make out, were never taken up by them in their search for social theory. Psychoanalysis bumped up against was influenced by and influenced social practices in Germany, Austria, Hungary, and the new Soviet Union. The later discredited Wilhelm Reich created non-authoritarian and sexually free youth clubs for German adolescents on Freudian lines. Anna Freud worked with teachers and analysts in a pedagogically minded school. And Freud, although resolutely looking at society from the perspective of the individual, nevertheless created some social theory in his books, Moses and Monotheism, Totem and Taboo, Civilization, Its Discontents. But in Britain, although Freud's translator, James Strachey, attended a summer school given by the Webbs in North Wales in 1910, the cross-fertilization that occurred between, let's say, literature and psychoanalysis appears to have bypassed mainstream British social science. And it's only been very recently that psychoanalytic ways of thinking have found partners within British social science, where the idea of the subject, of human agency, of reflexivity, have corresponded to equivalent notions in psychoanalysis. It's not that psychoanalysis was completely absent from thinking at the LSE. Between 1938 and 1939, Durbin instituted an investigation into the psychological causes of war. And one of the participants in that seminar was John Bowlby, probably one of the most influential of British psychoanalysts. But this seems to have been a one-off. In general, it would be safe to say that psychoanalysis in society and within the LSE has been confined to its more usual territory in social work policy and social work training. D.W. Winnicott, the important analyst and pediatrician, was a regular contributor to the Department of Social Science and Administration. And although we're increasingly seeing the family as the matter of mothers and babies and of private emotional life move more to the center of society's preoccupations, the extension of psychoanalytic thinking to concerns outside the domestic and the familial still has a long way to go. For most part, society's insights, psychoanalysis's insights, have been largely left unexplored by social policy. Psychoanalysis itself has had a very ambivalent attitude or ambivalent relationship to social issues. Although what Freud discovered in the consulting room during the analytic hour raised serious questions about the psychological damage caused by the organization of bourgeois, Victorian bourgeois social and domestic life, he clothed the revolutionary theory he was developing in the language and discipline of medicine, so that its social implications were not immediately apparent. And indeed, those of Freud's followers who were more eager participants in social or political reform, such as Adler, found little support within the psychoanalytic movement for the extension of their knowledge into the realm of the political or the social. And if they weren't exactly disciplined for such interests, they were dismissed from the inner circle or required to conceal their activities. And those who tried at a political level to draw on the links between psychoanalysis and social theory were hardly encouraged. Where psychoanalysis did enter into social policy was in the United States. There, a normalizing, desexualized, biologized psychoanalysis became a partner in the post-World War II social arrangements, generating theory about women's proper role and what she should be doing. With the return of men from war, psychoanalysis was employed to provide an ideological rationale for why women should surrender the jobs they'd enjoyed during the war and embrace their true roles as wives and mothers so that the men could re-inhabit the industrial landscape and thus confirm their masculinity. So its role in the United States is not something I think psychoanalysis has anything to be very proud about. I think it's been a very worrying partnership. So what is psychoanalysis today, and does it have relevance to social policy concerns? Is it really a theory about penises, phalluses, cigars, and hysteria? Can it be described as a clinical practice in which the analyst interprets to the passive patient her view on his dreams and other utterances? Is it a self-indulgent treatment that allows people to wriggle out of their responsibilities for their actions and their state of mind? Is it a practice that so enervated our culture that it has sapped the strength of those we used to rely on to be robust, the firemen, the police, the emergency services, so that they now require counseling to function? Now, I highlight these popular views of psychoanalysis because as psychoanalysis has permeated the culture more widely, both as a clinical practice and as an adjunct to intellectual endeavors such as cultural studies, media studies, gender studies, and literary studies. So it's become the butt of an extraordinary malevolence and caricature. Few other disciplines are treated in quite the same manner, dismissed and parodied without really being engaged with. What then is contemporary psychoanalysis, and what does it have to offer in terms of both a formulation of and solution to contemporary social and economic issues? Is there a way in which psychoanalytic ways of seeing can enhance our approach to social problems? Psychoanalysis is, above all, a clinical theory and a clinical treatment, and this is the preoccupation of most of its practitioners. But it's also many other things. Psychoanalysis has been able to detail the process of human psychological development and to propose mechanisms for understanding how the infant moves from being a dependent neonate, suckling at the breast, to becoming a human subject who establishes a personal idiom, a unique sense of self, and of personal agency. Psychoanalysis is also a theory of mental processes, detailing how we develop templates for managing experience, which we then have difficulty modifying in the light of new experience. It shows how we create meanings for ourselves. It can explain why something matters to an individual, why we care about things. It shows how we manage and mismanage our emotions, how and whether we develop the capacity to reflect on our experience, whether we develop the capacity for generative and reflective thinking, how we cope with indigestible experiences in the sense of where we put them, where do they go, and it's also a theory which explains the ubiquity with which we unwittingly repeat experience, even when it's not in our conscious interest to do so, as in the repetition compulsion. So psychoanalysis has also been the theory for understanding the process by which a biologically sexed infant becomes and feels itself to be gendered, a girl or a boy, how it actually takes on that category. Through the in-depth analysis of patients, through scrutinizing what's projected within the transference, which is the analytic instrument for understanding how an individual perceives another, through examining the latent and the manifest content of a patient's words, pauses and silences, and through a reflection of the analyst's experience of the patient, which is what we call the countertransference, psychoanalysis helps us to understand the psychological mechanisms underlying oft-times confusing and seemingly perverse human behaviors. It enables us to understand why the best intentions of individuals to change their actions often falters, not because of a failure of nerve or will, but because the internal structures that the psyche develops to fend off pain or manage difficulty render a stance of intransigence in the individual. From the perspective of social science and social policy, the psychoanalytic inquiry is relevant in five distinct ways. In the first instance, psychoanalysis hears. It bears witness to society's secrets. It listens to what is circumscribed or what cannot be said in many other places. And it endeavors to make sense of feelings, attitudes, desires, which are often against the grain of social propriety and yet are endemic to our psychological lives. As it listens, it absorbs and reflects on the underbelly of our social arrangements. Winnicott, for example, heard about the difficulties in literally thousands of mother-baby pairings. And the information he gathered, such as why mothers can hate their babies, could form the basis for many kinds of reflections. Everything from the effect of the nuclear family on the mothering person, to the impact of maternal isolation, to the social arrangements surrounding parenting. Of course, psychoanalysis has not itself been concerned to draw social conclusions. It's avoided any kind of critique, seeing its role rather to explicate individual psychic processes. But nevertheless, the analysis of individuals, of families, of couples, and mother and baby pairs is an unparalleled source of research data. A second way in which the psychoanalytic inquiry is of value is in what it studies. Its knowledge of child development, of interpersonal relationships, of the relationships between women and men, between babies and their mothers, children and parents, and its knowledge of group dynamics is an extremely rich knowledge base which is all too rarely used to underpin or guide social policy. It differs from other research methods in that it studies people as they are in the process of change. It stimulates self-reflective processes and is in the unusual position of being able to record them. As such, it holds a particular kind of knowledge about what makes change possible, what makes it falter, and what the experience of change is like for the individual, or for the family, or for the couple. A third way in which psychoanalysis has some significance for social policy is in its understanding of how emotional states can transform from one kind of thing into another kind of thing, when there's no channel for the acceptance of the original emotion. It observes that if a particular emotion, such as, say, disappointment or anger, is not received, can't be felt because in the child's milieu, such a feeling has no salience and therefore it can't be received, then the feeling, when experienced, cannot be straightforwardly felt and finished with. Instead, particularly if the feeling is repeatedly engendered in the individual, it can become a trouble to them, requiring them to handle it in some way. Psychoanalysis observes the intrapsychic pathways in which disappointment not felt, or not able to be felt, gets turned into anger, for instance. Or anger not allowed turns into withdrawal. I'm being incredibly superficial. But what I want to stress here is that it's the observation of the process that psychoanalysis has something to tell us about. And it can enable us to understand how the resulting compromise diminishes the individual's capacity to act in their own best interest. And it kind of warps or transforms their relationship to self. Now, these transformations in the internal life of the individual at the micro level have consequences inclining their behavior in particular ways, which make certain endeavors possible and others unlikely. Meanwhile, at a macro level, we can see a fourth way in which psychoanalytic ways of looking at the fracture in relationships provides us with deeper understandings and new keys with which to approach undesirable social phenomena that seem intractable, such as masculinity and violence, exclusion, the internalization of inferiority, the unconscious dependency dynamics between men and women, the ways in which women unintentionally cooperate in their own subordination, the deep feelings of unentitlement that can thwart the life chances of an individual, at the way power inflects relationships in particular ways, how individuals who are excluded feel, and so on. A fifth way in which psychoanalysis could be of value for social policy making is in its approach to the issues of meaning and motivation. A great deal of social policy initiatives depend upon an assessment of the rational responses of people and groups to changed or changing circumstances. Policymakers can be excellent at evaluating contingency and the ways in which changes in one arena have knock-on effects on others. But they're rarely in a position to either consider the meanings people make of their circumstances and thus their potential attitudes towards change, nor are they particularly able at grasping people's resistance to change. They can, as a result, misconstrue the motivation of those who are meant to be the beneficiaries of initiatives, develop a view about why such people are destructive on a higher level than, let's say, the Daily Mail does, lazy or indolent, and in their despair arrive at a position which unwittingly blames the victim. They take the behavior for the intent and see it as either inert or self-destructive, thus missing the point that the behavior, as perverse as it may seem to the outsider, is an expression of their agency and reflects the individual or the group's emotional understanding of their position. For example, they may not be able to see that in the face of powerlessness, violent and destructive behavior, such as trashing of shops and cars during riots, is experienced as transformative. It isn't that people are simply destroying the facilities, the good facilities in their environment, in their communities. They're transferring the bad feelings lodged within them to the perceived malign environment, shitting on it as they feel they've been shat on themselves. They're enacting in their behavior an expression of their inner world, which is, of course, a refraction of their social experience. By adopting a psychoanalytic approach to meanings and motivations, there's a way into understanding particular behaviors as an expression of the individual or the group's sense of agency. This stance allows one out of the cul-de-sac of recrimination and despondency that can affect both policymakers and their clientele. It may not make the behavior more palatable, but it may make it comprehensible. These five different aspects of the psychoanalytic project, if linked together, provide the basis for ways of approaching the elusive and yet crucial concept of personal agency, of subjectivity, which needs to be more addressed in social policy initiatives. The government of late has come to describe us citizens as consumers. And while for the most part this is an unfortunate notion, the one feature of consumerism that I think is apt relates to the idea of citizens as active participants rather than passive recipients of social policy. It is in this sense of us as active citizens that a psychoanalytic approach can enrich social policy initiatives. Psychoanalysis gives us no guide as to what are correct policies or how they should be implemented, but it does broaden the factors that we might want to consider when thinking about a policy initiative. In this way, psychoanalysis is no different than any other technocratic expertise. Statisticians, economists, sociologists, housing specialists, anthropologists, and so on, bring their knowledge to bear on the social policies they're addressing. They reformulate the problem in relation to the range of their own discipline and allow us to see things which may only have been in silhouette before. So too with psychoanalysis's contribution to social policy. It's not about revamping social policy to embody psychoanalytic ideas, but about bringing another texture, that of understanding human agency, to the consideration of and the transformation of social problems. In looking at the government's recent publication that came out of the Women's Unit in the Cabinet Office, Tackling Violence Against Women, which is an account of the various initiatives taken by councils and police forces across Britain in relation to violence in the household, a glaring absence from a psychoanalytic perspective is any discussion or notation of the psychological reasons why a woman may stay in a domestic situation in which she's being physically violated. Over the last two decades, we've witnessed a shift from the invisibility of violence perpetrated by men against women and an attitude which ran, there's not much wrong with women being pushed about a bit, or it's unfortunate but it happens, to a position in which it's now visible and redefined as a violent crime, domestic violence. The latest government statistics, and this report just came out 2 weeks ago, show that what women most fear is violence. And they reveal that almost half of all violent crime experienced by women, 44%, is domestic violence. A psychoanalytic view would want to look at the dynamics in violent relationships in a way that went beyond the purely formal consideration of the protection of the woman and the children. It's not that social theory in this area is bad, or social policy in this area is bad. Some local authority provision is good. The importance of safe houses and refuges has been recognized. The need for children and women to remain safe is understood. And the importance of the Crown Prosecution Services to find independent corroboration so that the ability to prosecute no longer depends on the individual woman's desire to do so, but enshrines the notion that domestic violence is unacceptable to us as a society, not just to the individual woman, is crucial. But what's missing from such a perspective, which is now firmly aligned with the woman as either victim or survivor, depending on your politics, is any sense of why a woman might feel compelled to stay within a violent relationship, or any discussion of the reasons that men can be violent, or of the interpersonal nature of such violence. Nor does it explore a woman's fidelity to a violent relationship when other factors, such as economic and social support, are potentially available to her. Policy statements hint at the confusion policymakers feel around this issue, for they now include sentences such as, and I quote, "The ultimate aims are to empower the woman to begin to take control over their lives and to help them make informed choices about their future," close quotes. And while I believe that policymakers firmly believe this, I think this sentiment is an attempt to pour soothing balm over a question that seems to be very difficult for them to address with their current intellectual instruments, namely, why women might persist in being in violent relationships. This is where psychoanalytic ways of thinking can be extremely helpful. Not in diverting funds away from providing housing or legal support services, but in being able to offer services which address the intransigence of such behaviors, or of certain behaviors. So what does it mean for a woman to have a violent relationship? How can psychoanalysis help us here? Psychoanalysis problematizes the violent relationship. It has a curiosity towards understanding the phenomena, and it attempts to pose questions which exempt the phenomena from a kind of moralism by asking instead, why does it occur? What keeps it going? What function does the violence have for the relationship, as well as the individuals involved? What keeps the woman in the relationship? Why, it questions, is a woman who finds herself in a violent relationship unable to extricate herself from it? Psychoanalysis does this first by enabling us to understand something about the experience of being in a violent relationship. It listens, it hears, and it asks, does the experience of being in a violent relationship transform the individual woman's sense of self? It answers the question by visiting some of the emotional territory of the woman in such circumstances, before it goes on to explicate the psychological mechanisms that enable her to tolerate this violation. In other words, what goes on inside of her to make this manageable. But first to the experience of being in a violent relationship, and the way it can then render the individual sense of herself and her possibilities. What's most palpable when sitting with a woman or women who are on the receiving end of violence is the deep sense of helplessness and defeat that can emanate from her. We might expect outrage and anger, and we might anticipate that such an emotional response would propel her out of the situation. But we find instead that even if the woman has not been in a previously physically or emotionally violent relationship, if she stayed in such a relationship beyond 3 or 4 incidents, the mechanisms of self-protection that we rely on to get us out of dangerous situations have been eroded. Next to the sense of helplessness and defeat may be some anger, but this is often overshadowed by an equally strong sense that while she's not at fault for engendering the violence, she feels herself to be responsible for transforming the conditions under which the violence occurs. One way in which she manages her feelings of helplessness is by taking on some culpability for it, by imagining that it is she, if only she could find the right key, who could shift the brutal behavior of the other. If only she could love him better, she could prevent the violence. If only she could love him better, she could repair the damaged man who turns violent on her. Thus, she protects herself from the feelings of helplessness and defeat by turning them into the opposite in her own mind. Instead of the woman feeling sunk by helplessness or hopelessness unconsciously, she feels some hope that she could, by her own actions, even if she doesn't know what those actions are, shift the awfulness, save herself and save him. A great deal of her mental ruminations may then be spent in trying to rework the situation so that the next time it occurs, it turns out differently. By relocating the problem, or if not the problem, at least the solution to the problem, from the perpetrator to herself, she becomes preoccupied with how she can reposition herself and her actions to prevent the violence from occurring. Now, we may judge that this is inaccurate, an example of false consciousness. And so we may say it isn't logical, it doesn't make sense. We may hope that a dose of corrective right-on thinking will set the woman right. But in fact, unless we address this turn that the psyche makes when it encounters persistent or repetitive unwarranted violence, we won't be able to devise programs that take sufficient account of a woman's sense of her own agency within this. At the same time as the psyche recasts the problem of the man's violence in terms of a solution the woman must find, the woman has the psychological problem of digesting what has actually happened to her. Here we can encounter an interesting paradox, for on the one hand, the woman knows very well what has occurred. She has the pain, the hurt, the shock, the upset, the horror. And as I've said, much of her psychic energy is invested in trying to fend off their reoccurrence. But another part of her episodically, not consistently, but episodically dissociates from what has transpired as though it never happens. In dissociation, which is one of the mechanisms that takes over when the psyche can't find a way to process difficult things, the disturbing event, along with the feelings that it provokes, are split off from the conscious mind of the individual. From the standpoint of dissociation, the woman who has been threatened or hurt forgets the violence that has occurred, and she normalizes the relationship. Her man's violence is temporarily effaced, and any conception of how, given who he is, he's likely to behave, based on her experience of him, is lost. The woman may go further. She may unconsciously create for herself a man who is caring, as many violent men can be. And so that when her man acts like himself, that is to say he turns nasty, she's in shock and unable to summon up whatever she imagines she might use to stop him or prevent him from hurting her or her children. She psychically disarmed herself in the dissociation, forgotten what she knows, and is therefore deeply unprepared to find whatever new form of engagement, whatever key she fantasized about finding, that will then persuade him to desist. Her behavior then in the next violent incident becomes not only a reflection of him in her mind, but one of her own failure. And it is from this stance that she is at one and the same moment trapped, and yet reassures herself that it is within her potential capacity to master and transform the situation. Of course, this isn't the only set of responses that it can occur in relation to a violent partner, although it's a frequently observed one. What's significant about it for social policy is that it provides us with something to hold on to when we're trying to understand the adhesive nature of violent relationships. We can see the way in which the woman believes herself to be an active participant with something to do. She doesn't actually experience herself simply as a victim or even a survivor of an abusive relationship. if we observe the range of responses of women who stay in relationships that are violent, or the ones that they're aware are extremely damaging to them, we can see that for some women, the experience of violence has been so rapidly corrosive that it stimulates feelings of unentitlement to anything better. In other words, the violent behavior seems to signify and encapsulate for the woman something essential about her. She may rail against it and wish to escape from the relationship, but she's fearful to do so. Feelings of personal value are so diminished that her being hit becomes not a signal to exit from the relationship, nor an outrage, but a plausible comment on who she is. To say this is not to blame the victim, and I want to be very clear about this. Unconscious psychic processes, which are an attempt to reverse for an individual deep feelings of powerlessness by translating them into plausible outcomes, is not equivalent with deserving one's status as a victim. It's merely to describe certain operations the psyche engages in order to manage profound distress. If we can get a hold of this thread, however uncomfortable it makes us, we then have another way into envisioning policies which take account of these knotty phenomena. The loss of personal value may, of course, play into a history for the individual woman in which she's not felt well regarded in her upbringing and therefore feels unable to take for granted within herself that she's a person of value. The ambiguity that many women have towards themselves and their entitlements is not a function simply of violent relationships per se, although it's an expression of the psychic violence that conditions of inequality can produce. For adult women today, a sense of self which embodies hesitancy, insecurity, feelings of fraudulence, and a confusion about their own entitlements is not unusual. The refraction of patriarchal social arrangements have not just intrapsychic consequences, they have depended upon the development of a particular psychology of femininity, which makes the reception of inequality both possible and sustainable. This disagreeable fact, which is something that gender-conscious psychoanalytic workers have had to take on, is not something that can be dispensed with by a dose of social policy initiatives which equalize in law the relations between sexes, although that helps. What is required is a more thoroughgoing understanding of the psychological development of masculinity and femininity, which may parenthetically, of course, yield some understanding of men's violence. The patriarchal requirements of femininity have meant that girls have been raised until very recently to occupy the social and psychological role of mother and carer, and to develop an identity through being attached to others as wives and mothers, and to provide for the needs of those others. Even though the social conditions of women have changed greatly in the last 20 years, the psychological mandates to respond to others, to provide for them emotionally and domestically, to offer relationships on which others can depend while not expecting reciprocal emotional responsiveness, means that adult women today can feel quite threatened at the idea of leaving or breaking up relationships, even if those relationships hurt them. They can fear a loss of a sense of self, for if they know themselves through their attachment, to sever those attachments is to lose a central component of the making of their personal identity. It's not a question of women being overly dependent. It's a question of how their identity has been structured and the role of attachment within it. Further, in being schooled to recognize and take account of the needs of others, they can experience extreme confusion in relation to their own needs, especially since they imbibe the idea that the needs of others are primary and overriding. Thus, a husband's needs, even those of a violent husband, may predominate. Or the woman may judge that the needs of her children to have a father or a man around are more important than their own needs for physical safety. Indeed, the woman's personal needs may be a trouble to her. There may be a hesitancy in relation to them, so that at the same moment as they arise, they're questioned by the woman herself. It's not so much that she actively undermines herself, as it is that she may not hear or recognize needs when they originate in her, for she is attuned to responding to needs that emerge from outside of her, from others. Thus she discounts what comes up from within her if the primacy of the other is not apparent. This isn't to say that women don't know that they're angry in the face of violence. Of course they do. Many women who are or have been in violent relationships are extremely angry about it. But the anger may not be enough to impel her out of the relationship. Curiously, her anger may entrap her. And here we have another problem that can confuse social policymakers. The woman's anger can appear to be an expression of her strength and the basis for a sense of self that refuses to be brutalized. And of course, in some ways, it is. But at the same time, her ability to express this anger and yet not act on it becomes almost like a safety valve that makes for homeostasis. She expels some angry feelings as a means of survival, which then allows her to endure a horrendous situation. But here's the rub. If her anger cannot be acted upon and yet is seen by social workers or counselors or survivors groups as a good thing, the emotional stepping stone to her making different choices, it can come to obscure other needs and sensibilities that exist in her, such as her fears of taking action, which are harder for her to address. Clinicians are accustomed to hearing much powerful rage emanate from a woman discussing how she feels about an abusive relationship. But it's as though the anger implodes. It gets stated, the man gets rubbished, the woman's contempt for his behavior is obvious, he's derided for his uselessness, and yet she stays in the relationship. Paradoxically, her anger can bind her to the situation because it includes more problematic feelings, feelings of vulnerability, feelings of fears of being on her own, fears that may be submerged. And part of what is difficult for the woman is to recognize her ambivalence. She wants out of the relationship, but she's scared to be detached. The capacity to make and maintain affiliative bonds are the hallmarks of femininity. And to reject those can feel paramount to rejecting the known self, and thus are too dangerous. At the same time, her socialization works to make her feel that for her to leave would be an act of aggression on her part. It is she who would be doing violence by instigating the separation. Unless women's ambivalence and their fears can be recognized, and unless their anger can be understood both as a means of survival and as a defense, the programs that are designed to enable them to take control over their lives and to help them make informed choices about their future will be ineffective. The question of a woman's anger is not straightforward at all. In addition to the ways in which I've discussed it, there are two other ways in which adept psychological understanding can aid policymakers in their quest to provide programs that don't, in the end, frustrate them and their clientele. The first of these concerns the way in which the battered woman, in becoming the recipient of violence, then takes on the bad feelings that the man who has beaten has towards himself. His violence is itself the manifestation of his inability to manage distress. This inability then inclines his feelings to become siphoned off in the direction of violence towards another. When the woman is beaten, she isn't just physically hurt, she is also the recipient of a set of angry emotions which then invade her psychic space so that she feels angry and rageful herself. She now has feelings which are not quite of her, but have been evoked in her and sit inside of her, which make her uncomfortable and feel somewhat alien. The batterer, having expelled and transferred his feelings, gets some relief. In fact, he's able to feel remorse, sorrow, and genuine love, for he's now no longer burdened by feelings that he couldn't process except through violent expulsion. There is then a devilish process by which the violence the man is endeavoring to rid himself of is induced in his partner. He feels differently for having released it, while she is swamped with a rage she doesn't quite understand. The situation may be somewhat different for those women who've come from a history of violence or of some kind of systematically abusive situation. Whatever the circumstances of our growing up, we seek to repeat aspects of the emotional temperature of the relationships which form the templates for our emotional lives. If one grows up in relationships in which violence is the means by which attachment or strong feelings are shown, violence, however much hated and feared, may resonate as the expression of love or as the proof of true connection. Although adults who suffered continued or continuous violence in their relationship with their parents or siblings or adult carers when they were little may seek to avoid violence in their adult life, violence can become a currency in a relationship with a deep resonance. It demonstrates that one really counts. One has got under the skin of the other, can move them to act in ways that they and oneself may not wish. Violence, while consciously rejected, may, because it equates with deep and primary connections, represent the truth of relationship. The enactment of violence then brings a certain kind of relief. While it's not actively sought, although of course it can be, it may nevertheless be the only way that a relationship can be felt to have meaning. The adult who knew violence as a child thus has a receptivity for violence at an intrapsychic level, which may perplex outsiders who cannot understand why the woman doesn't take the opportunity to get away from a violent relationship. Having raised the issue of what makes it possible for a woman to endure a violent relationship, we're then in a position to ask, is there anything we can understand about what is required to enable a woman to extricate herself from it and not endure it? Are there any measures we should put in place that will provide far more reaching support to enable women to make different choices? I think we can say unequivocally, yes. We need to build in programs, into the programs we offer, a response that addresses women's ambivalence, women's fears, and women's difficulties with leaving violent relationships. The kinds of ideas that I've suggested emerge from psychoanalysis are not hard to translate into social policy practice. They require thought, but they're really quite obvious. They suggest, for example, new ways of approaching group work, which, while not undercutting the sense of solidarity that women who have been violated can feel when they come together, also allows them to engage with their own fears of living. Of own fears of leaving, I'm sure living is part of it, of being on their own, of their own violence, and so on. It's also the case that in individual casework, sensitivity to women's ambivalence and their terror of losing their known identity is something that social workers or caseworkers could enable the women to work through. The psychoanalytic view also suggests that the training for workers should sensitize them to the complex meanings of anger in women who've been physically abused, who on the one hand proclaim their fury and seem like fighters, and on the other hand seem stuck in very damaging relationships. If the workers understand more of the complexity of the dynamics, they could be more helpful to their clients. Anticipating their clients' ambivalences and conflicts, they may end up less confused and disappointed when women refuse to save themselves. And they may help their clients to work through these conflicts to a different conclusion. The workers may also burn out less frequently as they realize the ways in which a side effect of the violence their clients experience produces in them a sense of being failed saviors too, much as their clients are failed preventers of violence. And finally, although this is by no means an exhaustive list, just an outline of areas in which policy could be refreshed, a psychoanalytic perspective may enable a different kind of provision towards men who are violent, one that recognizes not just the social and economic roots of their violence, but the psychological origins and functions of their violence and what it is there to manage. I've sketched a way in which psychoanalytic thinking opens up new dimensions in the understanding of damaging social problems and suggests ways in which policy initiatives could be strengthened by consideration of this dimension. A crucial aspect of the approach I outline is it sees the problem of the self-destructive behavior, staying in a violent relationship, as a too simplistic and reductive account which bypasses the crucial aspects that can enable the individual to change. By understanding the woman's agency, her participation in the process, what she sees as her contribution, we have the means to offer her new perspectives on change, which then enhances the possibility of her making different kinds of choices. I chose to speak about domestic violence because of the recent government initiatives on gender and its paper tackling violence against women. But I hope you will see that the psychoanalytic way of approaching this particular social policy could be applied in many areas that may not at first appear as natural companions. Social aspects of economic policy, psychoanalysis and development, anti-poverty programs, the reform of welfare. I am not, as I hope I've demonstrated, suggesting that psychoanalysis can in any way substitute for our conventional research tools and instruments. It can, however, underpin them by addressing dimensions that often go unrecognized. Thank you very much.
Wonderful, Susie. Thank you very much. Susie will now take a few questions from the floor before we all go and have a break. Is there anyone who'd like to start the discussion? 1 minute to shuffle around.
Well, shrinks can handle silence. You know, we don't have difficulty with that.
I know. Social anthropologists do. Yes, please.
Stand up, then we'll all hear you.
Yeah. What do you think the greater economic power of women might have on domestic violence? Also, can I just add to that, and it affects another whole area, the effect of the nuclear family, the focus on the nuclear family in the last 20 years, and the loss of perhaps the power of the extended family.
Okay, did you hear the question? Okay, I think I'll stand actually. I finally had enough of sitting. The question is what do I think women's greater economic power, or women's increased economic power, what effect has that had on violence? And what effect have the changes in the nuclear family, it's being stripped down to being a nuclear family and cut off from wider intergenerational relationships, what effect does that have? I think those are very good questions for a research project, actually. I don't think we can quantify the first question, because I don't think we looked at domestic violence significant as a serious problem before. So I don't think that we can now make an argument about whether it's had a larger or greater effect. And also because it wasn't possible for women to come forward before, and it is now, it looks as though there's an explosion in domestic violence. And I think that it would be very easy to write that off as, well, it's because women have become so stroppy that men are now feeling helpless and powerless, and they have no way to express the new sexual arrangements and helplessness and et cetera, et cetera. Now, I think you could make that argument, but I don't think we have the evidence for it yet. So I can't give you a response on that. And I'm not sure that, in regards to your second question, I'm not sure in regards to the splitting off of the nuclear family, I think we know it ain't much good. I think we know it causes tremendous isolation, and sort of the privatization of mothering is extremely problematic for an awful lot of women who are doing the parenting, the privatization of domestic life. I do think, though, that violence is often intergenerationally transmitted. So it's not that to somehow have more collective ways of living would necessarily obliterate or challenge the conditions under which so much of the violence which is hidden can continue. Because I think we know of mothers who passed on to daughters the silence about being violated, and that's gone on through the generations. I don't know, I think what you're talking about are really the kinds of areas that need to be investigated properly with these other dimensions of experience. And I think it'd be very easy to be facile at this point about the shifts, only because we're seeing it being recognized rather than because we actually have the data. Somebody over there? Well, I think the model of how one digests any kind of violation that's systematic and continual, living with a bully or being tortured, being assaulted, verbally assaulted, being made to take the blame for things, I think you can apply exactly the same model. I mean, it's not an original model. I'm using Fairbairn's model of how in the internal world deals with the indigestible. How it transforms those into experiences that you potentially have control over. How the mind becomes split, and then one part of you imagine very, very different sets of outcomes with all sorts of possibilities. So yes, no, of course it doesn't just relate to physical violence. I think it relates to almost anything that we experience as indigestible, any feeling that you can't just be finished with.
Hello?
Oh, yes.
Does it work?
Yes, you can be heard.
Freud said, I believe, that the trouble is women don't know what they want. Women don't know what they want. And when you say psychoanalysis has understood that women fear violence more than anything, have they also understood what women cherish most, or do women really understand?
Well, I think, can I just make a disclaimer? I mean, having introduced Freud at the beginning, and I really didn't mean the Freud of interpretation. I meant the Freud of personal meaning and the Freud of the method of the analytic hour. So it isn't about the specific interpretations that Freud saw. So that's, I'd just like to say that. And I think, you know, so many of us have written books, so many sort of contemporary feminists have written books called What Do Women Want, taking Freud's phrase, you know, that he despaired of knowing what women wanted. I don't think it's that psychoanalysis knows that what women fear most is violence. That's a kind of regular social science research. I think what gender-conscious psychoanalysis is thinking in terms of what it's observed in terms of the cherishing is these aspects of affiliation and relationship and the capacity to give and receive. So, I mean, whether one would say that is across the board, it depends whether you actually believe that psychoanalysis, in looking at the individual in depth, has anything to say about what's going on for all of us. If you believe that, then I think you can say psychoanalysis says this. If you don't believe in the psychoanalytic method as being valid, then you can't. But I think women, the value of psychoanalysis is, and that's why I started with that it hears, is that it actually hears a lot of different melodies going on at the same time. It doesn't simply hear what is acceptable in the room in the outside world. It hears what's unacceptable. And what's unacceptable often is disappointment, hate, hurt, anger, all of those things which are feelings that arise out of huge, complicated disappointments in love and connection and affiliation.
What prospects do you think that the ideas of psychoanalysts will be taken on under the policy sort of decision by the policymakers and the present government? And has in fact there been much in the way of kind of consultative exercises so far, or is this something of a wish list?
I think it's a wish list. I think what they've done is throw money at a few programs. You deal with it without actually thinking that the programs have something to tell them about how to design the policy. But I was talking with Tessa Jarl about this material this week. So, and okay, she's very exceptional. Let's face it. I mean, her background is exceptional to be a minister, but she is in public health and she is also a minister of women. So I'm not completely pessimistic about the possibilities. And I think there is a groundswell of opinion. And the problem is that my discipline is so unready to codify its work in a way that's acceptable that it makes it very hard for those policymakers to come towards it in any kind of way. I mean, there are people who are doing work on attachment who have things that look like policy documents that policymakers can understand. There's attachment interviews and the adult attachment, you know, there's all sorts of things. But the general notions haven't been translated yet, and I think it's a really good opportunity at this moment to begin to do it, because I do think they are quite desperate, which is why they've hedged in their documents with these kinds of statements. Well, you know, when I wrote this lecture, I was thinking, well, what lecture shall I do next? Shall it be on men's violence? And then should the third one be on the interaction? Or shall I just sort of do psychoanalysis and some other bit of social policy, right? I don't know what violence is. I mean, I think that is a wonderful question. What is violence? Why violence? I mean, we can observe it. Well, I think that we certainly with male patients, my experience is, without being desperately superficial, is that it has an awful lot to do with the feelings that wind up in the women, which is tremendous feelings of frailty and helplessness. Has to do with not being able to assimilate, if I can be generalized about this, because obviously...
His frailty.
Well, I wouldn't even put it as inferiority, but his feelings of frailty. Of not knowing what you do with feelings that are extremely raw, scary, vulnerable making. Now, there are two routes for men, right? One, I mean, we brought men up to be killers until, just as we brought women up to be mothers and carers, so we brought men up to be killers until recently. That was one of men's functions. They were to be providers and killers. And it's very recently that we don't bring them up to be killers in Britain. And so a mechanism, I think that's true. I don't think we should underestimate the importance of that. Now, what do you do when you feel shaky and vulnerable? You use defense mechanisms to protect yourself. And one of those is probably something to do with the derivation of whatever it was we developed in boys' psychologies in order to enable them to manage to go out and be in the killing. That's one piece. The second piece, I've forgotten what I was going to say, but a third piece that's come to me, maybe it'll come back to me, is that I don't think there's one... The thing about psychoanalysis is it doesn't have one overall interpretation, right? Its beauty is in its subtlety, not in its... Its broad strokes is what I've had to give you today, but it's really in the subtlety of understanding the differences, although out of that, then you can draw pictures. But I think that the sense of, oh, I know what I was going to say. The vulnerability can go two directions, it seems to me. One is into the violence, in the kill, you know, as a derivative of the being brought up to be killers. The other is, I think a lot of men's anxieties go into sexualizing relationships. Out of, at least in my clinical experience, you know, forget what's in the culture, which I think we can all see is out there. But the anxiety that can't be felt is either expelled sexually or physically. I mean, they're both physical, I suppose. But those are kind of the two routes in the way that women manage their anxieties through taking care of others and losing themselves, etc. So I think I'd approach it from that point. It would be very similar sorts of anxieties, but that are structured in a boy's psychology in an entirely different way.
Right. We'll just take two more questions, one here and one there.
I ask you a question about how people within social policy might cope with some of the things that come out of this process. I'm really sympathetic to it, but I think the example you've given of women and violence, it's a sort of psychoanalysis coming in to deal with a problem that's already leaked, if you like. But I think you can see many other areas where psychoanalysis would uncover problems which at the moment are preventing social policy from working, that are invisible. I've been doing work on people's reactions to their built space. Simulate their space is the only way that they know how to survive. Now, if I compare that to the World Bank policy of people taking control of their lives, you can see that evidently this is never going to work. You can only survive by blocking out your built space. But at the same time, I can see that somebody like me coming in, uncovering that, listening in a different way, is quite a dangerous process because it's not controlled in any way like your clinical process is when you use psychoanalysis. I think there's a kind of disjuncture there with what might come up and how policy can then address it and who is there to work with those things.
Well, I think what you've put your finger on is this is the problem that needs to be addressed. I really don't think it's insurmountable. I just don't think we've put enough heads together to think about it. And in fact, one of the places that is interested in psychoanalysis and social policy in a tiny little bit of it is the World Bank at the moment. So, I mean, one little bit of it is very interested. So I think that the fact that a dialogue is beginning to happen around this means that even if we haven't perfected a way of doing it yet, I mean, I don't think we have, doesn't mean that we don't need to start the process by which we use the analytic tools in the same way as we do any other technocrats. And I think psychoanalysis is extremely subversive, but this is not what I'm suggesting its uses is in this area, right?
You're not worried about getting outside the
No, not at all. I mean, it's not as, you're not using it as a clinical practice, you're using it as, right, but any time people's consciousness becomes expanded in any way, it's both wonderful and dangerous and exciting and scary. And that's the project of being human, isn't it? I mean, that is what we have to take on board.
There's a quick follow-up. All right, it was about built space. And imagining that you're living, I imagine, in green fields as opposed to in shanty towns, which you can sympathise with all working in the LSE. Just take one question. Speak into it, you'll be fine.
I think really I had a question about the practicality really of applying psychoanalysis to the macro level. So for example, as economists, when we build models of the economy, we have to assume, for example, that households are unitary. We have to in general assume that roughly people behave in the same way. We have to assume people are rational, all that kind of thing. Because rational has very specific meanings, that's what I'm saying. But because it is in practicality extremely difficult to build models that allow for variations, I think it could be very difficult to build economic policies that try really to encompass all the variations in human behavior that are also subconscious as well as conscious. And I think my other point might be, certainly, I mean, thinking about people in economics, I think one of their first points would be, I'm not saying I share this view, would be, for example, the question that isn't it really that the point about psychoanalysis is that it deals with that particular individual or that particular couple's sort of circumstances, emotions, dynamics, backgrounds that are particular to them, and therefore in a way can't be replicated for everyone else. Do you see what I'm driving at?
I absolutely see what you're driving at. Look, there is an aspect of psychoanalytic practice that is about the individual or the couple or the group. But there's also what psychoanalysis tells us about the experience of being in our society. That is the piece I think it would be possible, and people's behaviour, and that is the piece I think it would be possible to build in. I really don't see why it should be that difficult.
Well, I mean, I was going to say domestic violence is an easy example. I didn't mean that in the wrong way. But for example, trying to understand, let's take the idea of redefining, remanaging welfare.
Mm.
Now, it would be extremely difficult to try and think how to encompass people's sort of individuality, if you like, within structuring that economically. I mean, you know, doing this in theory is one thing, or ideology, but doing it in practice.
You know, I really don't see it. I mean, I maybe we'll have to talk afterwards, because I don't see the problem with that. In fact, I don't understand how it can be done without that kind of thinking. I just don't see how the programs that are going to work, because I don't think they have...
Yes, I agree with you. I think that one of the problems with economics is it's too theoretical. I mean, a lot of the time it doesn't work. I mean, I'm not disputing that, but I think it's literally... I'm not even disputing anything. I'm asking you about how exactly the process could be done.
Right, well, I think I've got probably as far... It's not that I couldn't get further in my thinking, but I do think at this point there need to be other people, a group of people working on it, because we need to address the very, very... Until we get psychoanalysts and psychotherapists on the policy-making bodies to see what their contribution is and what it isn't, we actually won't know the parameters of what that that contribution is. So I think I'm making a plea for this kind of thinking to... Because there's a way in which psychoanalytic thinking can do the worst possible thing, which is to copy psychology and try to do that kind of research, which I don't think is interesting at all, and it reduces what psychoanalysis has to offer to a denominator that I don't think is valid particularly. So I think it's more about, if you expand the conversation, what does it then allow the economist to think, right?
Well, that's what I'm asking you.
No, but that's what, but then we'd have to have it on. Okay, so we'd have to take the welfare stuff or reform and actually talk all the way through. I'm sorry to be giving such a an anodyne answer, but I can't do it in this context.
No, I mean, I think, as you say...
And it's not just because psychotherapists and psychoanalysts don't answer questions.
No, I mean, would I suggest that? But no, I mean, I think... I would agree with you. I think it needs an interdisciplinary sort of panel or whatever to really sit down and see what they can offer each other. But whether that will happen, I doubt it, but...
Great. Well, that seems like a wonderful place to stop. I'd just like to... say that we would be very pleased to welcome you all upstairs to the fifth floor, I always get this wrong, fifth floor, to have a drink with us afterwards to celebrate this lecture. But before that, I would just like to thank Susie Orbach very much for giving us a whole range of new perspectives on social change and indeed on the resistance to social change, which is much more important. And I think I should close by saying I think the women on this platform definitely do know what they want, which is a drink.